It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. He's a jazz trumpeter, a singer, an orchestra leader, and now Byron Stripling has been named the principal, the Pittsburgh Symphony's second ever principal pops conductor. Byron, welcome to Pittsburgh and to the Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was it about this position with this symphony that struck a chord?
Well, think about it. We're talking about Pittsburgh Symphony. From the time I was a kid, you'd listen to all the great recordings of the symphony orchestras. And at the top of the list, you've got all these other ones. You've got Chicago and this and that. But then, of course, the Pittsburgh Symphony. There's something special about it. I don't know if it's the water or what you guys are dealing with, but this is one of the great orchestras in America. So, yes. Yes, Pittsburgh.
The symphony itself has struggled in recent years under the weight of its own debt. Those concerns were realized publicly a few years ago with a lengthy strike by players themselves. When you were making the decision to come to Pittsburgh, did those financial pressures weigh at all in your decision?
Musicians are always dealing with financial pressure. That had absolutely nothing, and I care nothing about any of that. The music blows away any concerns about any of that kind of stuff. As artists, we live in the field of infinite possibilities. And so those things have largely been resolved by an amazing board and things like that. So that's not something that was ever on my mind. Music is central on my mind, and it's the thing that I know will uplift the people throughout Pittsburgh.
Did you view the PSO as sort of an organization on the mend, though?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize that is not a concern of mine. My concern is the music. Like, I'm a guy that's all about feeling and music and uplifting people through music. So I don't go and say, can I see your books? I'm not an accountant.
Is it a fun mission to sort of, get to help formulate the future of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra?
Now you're singing my song. Absolutely. And this is why you're there. You have the potential to have an incredible impact upon something that has legacy, right? Almost over 100 years the Pittsburgh Symphony has been in existence, and there's this incredible legacy. And people like Marvin Hamlisch created that on the pop side of it. Lorne Mazel, Previn, so many other great conductors on the classical side. There's a potential if I don't, as my wife says, don't mess this up. That's very clear. So then this is not an issue for me because this is my life. This is where I live. This is where the juice of life comes from me, uplifting people through music. So I have a chance to do that with this orchestra.
So the joy of being on the creative side. What sort of program are you imagining for the PSO Pops?
I can say it in three words. Pat your foot. Right? When you come in to see the Pittsburgh Symphony and Byron Stripling's on that podium, pat your foot. Feel good. So the other thing that's great about the live performance experience, what I want all your listeners to know is that what the Pittsburgh Symphony gives you cannot be heard or felt on iTunes, on Spotify, and on YouTube. We want you to listen to all those things, but we want you to come into the concert hall and get the humanity of the experience of that music come off that stage with an orchestra that's playing live music for you. These are musicians that are sitting there with no safety net. There is no audio tune. Do you know what auto-tune is? Mm-hmm. That's when they take the voice and they make it something that it's not. Mm-hmm. There's no artificial intelligence up there. There's no drum machines. It's live music. And you get to experience that and it comes off the stage to you. And guess what? In a Byron Stripling performance with the Pittsburgh Symphony, if you like it, I need you to moan and tell me it feels good. I need you to say, yeah, baby. And I want to hear you. I need you to snap your fingers and clap your hands. And I want you to respond to me. And then because of the improvisational nature of that, then you will help us. Your moan, your clapping, your sigh is going to help us with that music. So this is what we envision.
You're a jazz man by trade. Can we expect that background to make itself heard?
Are you kidding?
What a ask.
You're asking the redundant questions. So in the glory and the beauty of jazz is just what I described to you. It's improvisation. So from my performances, if you're going to yell something back to me in the audience, you're going to get another yell back from me, even if you're trying to heckle me. I'll get you right back. But we do it musically, too. And so everything that happens on that stage is spontaneous. It's going to be like watching Shakespeare write something. It's going to be like watching Beethoven compose music. You get to be a part of that.
Principal, pops, conductor, sort of a cool gig, usually means less traditional repertoire. PSO has been integrating hip-hop, other genres for a few years now, hosting Star Wars and Harry Potter nights. Do you feel that pops is more inviting, more accessible for the audience?
No.
No?
All music is accessible to people. You just have to open your heart. So, you know, Helen Keller said, all the greatest things are not the things that can be seen, but the things that can be felt. All right, so if I can get you in the concert hall, the best concerts that I give are the ones nobody knows what the heck the music is. Mm-hmm. People are so used to familiarity. They're going to get it with me. We're going to get all the things that you love. So that's going to be folk. It's going to be rock. It's going to be pop. It's going to be all those things. But I'm going to always, even if I have a chance in a concert to throw something that's related to the thing that you know, many times you're going to leave the stage and that's going to be the thing that you remember from that concert, that one thing that you didn't have knowledge of. So all music is accessible. All great music is accessible. You know, music, as I said before, musicians live in the field of infinite possibilities, and it's up to us to expose the individual and the audience to those things. We're charged with that, and we accept that challenge because that's how you're going to be uplifted by art, not by just looking and hearing the same. So we give you a little bit of that, but then we shake it up and we add it. That's why we add improvisation to it, too. Mm-hmm. That gives you a little twist on everything. We do it our way. Have it your way, Pittsburgh your way.
If you're just joining us, we're in studio with the PSOs.
You're going to say, just joining us, there's a drunk guy on singing on the Have It Your Way, Pittsburgh Your Way.
No, he is.
You have not even legalized the marijuana. You got the medical. You haven't even got, and I'm still going crazy here.
Well, we love the enthusiasm. He is Byron Stripling, the newly named Principal Pops Conductor. And his first performance should come later this fall in October. A note to our listeners, WESA does receive funding from the PSO. So, you know Pittsburgh's rich jazz history. We're very proud of all the accomplishments, all the wonderful artists who have come here. You've performed here. Any jazz artists here in town you already know, already have friendships with?
Well, there's one that just left you. You lost him, Sean Jones.
Yeah.
He is one of the great jazz trumpet players in the world. He's my idol, and he's younger than me, and I'm mad at him because of it. I wish I was as cute and played like that. Wow, what an amazing player. And then you also, how do you say it? Manchester Craftsman Skills?
Yes.
How do you say it?
Yes.
What an amazing place. I played there over 10, 15 years ago, I think, with Bill Strickland there. What an amazing place that you have there. There's so much culture. You guys are rich in great artistic achievements, and I hope that I can add my little piece to that.
Will you be sitting in, maybe, aside from your gig, aside from your responsibilities with the Pops, will you be sitting in with any of these jazz artists, you think?
If they let me, I'm going to say, I just was at a studio and they had a piano there. You don't have a piano here, do you?
Not just now.
You just lost a gig. I was going to play for you.
Somebody get a piano in here.
I want one of those acoustics pianos. Yeah, that real stuff. So, yeah, of course, if there's a chance to play, that's why I exist. Again, that's where the juice comes from, actually playing.
Mm-hmm. You've performed here, but how important is it to ingrain yourself into that community?
Well, you know, I'm not here for long periods, but when, you know, a week, maybe we can extend that to a week and a half. First thing I'm going to do is eat all the food y'all got because I need to sample as much food as possible and then give my take on it. So then I'll write an article and give you a food review when I come back. But the second thing is that, yeah, if there's a time I can go sit in and play with somebody, I like to play with anybody. If there's a group of drummers over somewhere, let me sit in and play my trumpet with them. Let me sing with them. See, I've already been singing for you.
You've been singing
with me? And so far you don't like it so much, so I have to figure out a song you might like.
Oh. Go ahead.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. That's Gershwin. You like Gershwin?
Yes, Gershwin.
You got to do a little Gershwin. And then you got Louis Armstrong. Oh, what good is sitting alone in your room? You didn't like that? You don't
I
like
do.
Louis Armstrong?
I do. Okay. I do. I do like Louis. Okay. I do. You mentioned very briefly. Sure. You mentioned very briefly that you'll use the podium as a delivery system to uplift the community. In what concrete ways do you think music can accomplish that?
Oh, well, just the fact that music is food for the soul. provides valuable nourishment for you. So the mere act of hearing that, hearing great music, if you open your heart as a listener, and that's part of my job, to make that the audience amenable to that open heart, we've got some music for you that will uplift you. That's the core reason that we play music. That's the reason that music exists. Without music, life would be a mistake.
What are some of your community engagement plans, especially involving young people, education, the schools?
Right. So it's so important for us that all this great music will actually die if the young people aren't attracted to it. So part of my thing is, if when I have the chance, when I'm here, if I can go to a school and sort of point people's ears towards those great things in music to listen to, especially young people, we know they know about Ariana Grande. They know about all the latest pop. They know Kanye West. Mm-hmm. But they're great living artists that will play on the stage of the Pittsburgh Symphony in the coming weeks. They need to know those too. I'm going to be bringing guests in the same way. So this is how we use it. The music is a delivery system to make you feel good. And what we provide has no side effects. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a drug. So you can take that drug, if you will, of listening to great music, whether it's Louis Armstrong, whether it's Miles Davis, whether it's Paul Simon, whether it's Aretha Franklin. All of that great music has the power to uplift you.
All right. Just two sentences. Final question. What do you say to the young kids about what you're going to be doing?
I'm here to play great music for you. This music is for you. So listen to violins, violas, cellos, basses. Listen to woodwinds and brass and percussion. Music is more than just a guitar and that floppy hair. It has the power to move you. We're here to move Pittsburgh, baby.
And you can get that enthusiasm in the kids?
Yes, absolutely. That's my thing. You know I'm crazy, so kids love me.
Byron Stripling is the new principal pops conductor for the PSO. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, physician Charity Jane Vincent dies in 1902 in her home in Allegheny City, now the North Side. Vincent was the first female doctor in that community, earning her medical degree at the Women's Medical College in Philadelphia. She operated a private practice out of her home in Allegheny City, which was then the third largest municipality in the state. Dr. Vincent also worked for the Pittsburgh Infirmary, and her private practice also served as one of four available physicians for the United Presbyterian Orphanage at the corner of Monterey and Jacksonia Streets. She died suddenly at the age of 49 in her home on North Avenue. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
Join Molly Wood from Marketplace Tech Report and a panel of local business leaders for lunch and a conversation about the future of tech in Pittsburgh, Thursday, January 30th at the Carnegie Science Center's Point View Hall. Tickets are $50, available at wesa.fm/Molly Wood.
The Pittsburgh region's healthcare sector could be poised for significant economic growth this year. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA. After years of legal wrangling, UPMC and Highmark worked out a deal in 2019, giving most Highmark customers in-network access to UPMC doctors and hospitals. I spoke recently with Pittsburgh Business Times health reporter Paul Guff about how their new relationship might play out in 2020.
Over the last several years of court battles and consent decrees, that it expired, you had a UPMC plan for your employer or a Highmark plan for your employer, or sometimes both, depending on what your situation was and how big the company was. And now that's a lot less for most people. You always have to say that, most people. But it's a lot less stressful because Highmark will be able to be covered by UPMC.
So this feud, so to speak, it's mainly in the rearview mirror. What will the focus now be shifting to for these two healthcare giants moving forward?
And they are really healthcare giants. They're unlike a lot of markets in the United States, they own both insurance and providers, which makes it a very much more full-flavored competition. So what they'll be doing really is spending a lot of time increasing their provider offerings, their hospitals, their programs within hospitals. I'd say the North Hills actually is going to be a big battleground. Highmark, which owns Allegheny Health Network, is going to be opening a hospital called Wexford Hospital in the next year and a half. And that will be their first really stake in the ground on the hospital side. And then UPMC will probably counter them as well with other programs at Passavant and through their outpatient in Cranberry.
How is this going to affect employment in the area?
They're all going to be hiring. The neighborhood hospitals at AHN is a building in Harmer, in McCandless, in Hempfield Township, and also in Brentwood. Those have about 150 employees because it's a 24-hour hospital and emergency room. And then Wexford, same thing, actually more because they'll have an OB ward there, which is one of the first new ones to be built in a long time in Pennsylvania. And then there's the three specialty hospitals that UPMC is building. One will be built 2021. That's at Mercy. That'll be a vision and rehab hospital. And then the other two, a heart and transplant hospital and a cancer hospital, that timeline's been extended a little bit, so that'll be probably within the next 4 or 5 years.
What does the building boom mean in terms of construction jobs in the region?
Yeah, actually, I think it's going to probably be a pretty big year for construction. You've got the Shell cracker plant, which is taking 6,000 to 7,500 workers from not just the tri-state region, but also from around the country. You've got what's happening at the airport, the new terminal. You have the Lower Hill District, and then where the Civic Arena was. And I think that that's another place that we'll see in the next year or two a lot of construction. So you've got a lot of construction jobs they've been telling me that the union halls are pretty empty. And with what I've seen, I agree.
That's Pittsburgh Business Times health reporter Paul Goff. In Pittsburgh Business News headlines, a new year brings a new name for the outdoor concert venue formerly known as Key Bank Pavilion. The Burgettstown site is now called the S&T Bank Music Park. Indiana, PA-based S&T made the sponsorship announcement this past week in conjunction with Live Nation Entertainment. The Butler Health System announcing this week it will open a primary care facility in Elwood City. The Butler Eagle reports it's not clear whether the new center in the North Star Plaza was planned in response to the recent closing of the Elwood City Medical Center. And footwear and apparel company Brooks Running has extended its partnership as a sponsor and supplier with P3R, the company behind the Pittsburgh Marathon, through 2022. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On March 9th, 2016, five people, including a woman who was 8 months pregnant, were shot and killed during a cookout at a home in Wilkinsburg. Sharon Shelton of Lincoln Lemington and Robert Thomas of Wilkinsburg are charged with 5 counts of homicide and 1 count of homicide of an unborn child. Jury selection began Monday, but then Judge Edward Borkowski closed off the proceedings to the public and the news media after a juror contacted a court official to say they were scared because information about them was published. David Harris is a University of Pittsburgh law professor and is WESA's legal analyst. He joins us from the East End. David, good morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
David, how unusual is this? A single juror taking offense and a judge barring everyone from that point forward?
It's not unusual sometimes for a juror to be upset or take offense or be surprised. However, it is unusual for a judge to close an entire jury selection proceeding to all news media and the public.
So what are the criteria for deciding to do so?
The criteria are that these proceedings are presumptively open to both the public and the media. And also that juror names are presumptively public. We don't know if these jurors were told that, and maybe that's why the juror was surprised. In order to close a proceeding like this, a judge has to conclude that there is simply no other way to handle whatever problems have arisen. So you start with the default presumption that these will be open because the public and the media have a right to observe to make sure the trial is fair.
Is it up to the judge's discretion? How much leeway does the judge have? The Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, has supported closure in some instances.
The judge has a lot of discretion, but that discretion is supposed to be used with a lot of leavening, in the sense that you wouldn't go to the absolute maximum of closing a trial or a jury selection proceeding unless there was no other way.
Does the nature of this specific trial make a difference at all?
The nature of the trial makes a great deal of difference. This was a trial that was reported on a lot. It was a terrible, terrible incident. A member of the jury could be afraid that having his or her name in the public might cause him to be subject to intimidation, something like that. We don't know exactly what the juror was afraid of because it wasn't specified in the judge's statement, but we do know that this is a trial of great public concern and interest, and that makes the interest of the public and the media even more important, given the concerns about fairness and having the right defendants in the defendants' chairs.
And the nature of this case, law enforcement prosecutors have described it as an ambush-style mass shooting. And of course, it's a capital trial.
Absolutely. A death penalty trial. The stakes could not be higher. The stakes for the public are great, too. The public has to know that it can be safe doing a backyard barbecue. So all of this is a terrible, terrible clash in which we have a bad crime. We have people on trial for their lives. We have to get it right. That is the bottom line. And in order to get it right, public scrutiny and openness are actually quite important. We want those things to happen so we can have confidence in the process.
So is that the concern, if the process is not open, some sort of impropriety?
Well, the public wants to have that kind of openness in general so that we can have confidence that everything has been done right. You know, we have due process and procedures in this country for the defendants, of course, but for our own sake, too, because those are our values. And in order to do something like impose the death penalty, we not only have to be sure we have the right people, we have to be sure we did it the right way, because that's who we are. It really has as much to do with our values as being fair to the defendants.
Is there any information that the media, the public, are guaranteed that their judge can't bar access to, even if a juror protests?
Well, like I said before, the names of jurors are actually presumptively public. Some information is going to come out in the run-of-the-mill case. Judges can make rules for a specific case that would bar, say, disseminating those names in the press. That's the kind of accommodation we look for in a court. Simply barring all access does seem to me to overshoot the mark. You want to protect the process, make the jurors feel comfortable being candid and deliberating in good faith, but you also need to accommodate the public's right to see and know and understand that the trial has been done in ways that are fair and just.
A ruling will be issued any minute now. What's your expectation?
My expectation is that the judge will scale back yesterday's decisions, barring everybody, that some kind of accommodation will be found short of that.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, and he's the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It sounds like science fiction, but a new book explores how scientists, backed by big money, are seeking to extend human life indefinitely. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll spoke with Chip Walter, the Pittsburgh-based author of Immortality, Inc., Renegade Science, Silicon Valley Billions, and the Quest to Live Forever.
Chip, how did we go from our long fascination with anti-aging schemes, wrinkle creams, mm-hmm. special diets and things like that, to trying to, as you put it, cure death?
I think that one of the reasons was because of a futurist and engineer named Ray Kurzweil. Kurzweil's been around a while, but he was one of the first people to be able to credibly argue that we really don't have to die from aging. We may die of other things, but we don't have to grow old and just kind of clatter away. His books His other work about accelerating technologies really began to influence other people that were important inside of Silicon Valley.
Isn't the idea that we might live 200 or 300 years, let alone forever, still kind of fringe science at this point?
This is a paradigm shift that people don't see yet. Truthfully, when I started work on it, I thought this is crazy. But by the time I got through it all and saw the science, I came to the conclusion, my God, they're going to pull it off.
As of today, what are the major scientific challenges facing these efforts?
Well, the biggest problem is that we are kind of built to age. And there's an evolutionary reason for that. The underlying genetics of why we age is really at the heart of this. And if you can figure out why we age, and there are other animals in the world that don't seem to age, then can we figure out a way to simply stop aging? And also turn the clock back so that you can not only live as long as you currently are living, but actually get younger.
This is an incredibly complex problem, as you acknowledge in the book. What does make you think that they can pull it off?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is the information that we're gathering about the genome is very important. Also, the acceleration of computer science. So we're just gathering way more information, way faster, and we're developing much more intelligent algorithms and machines that can figure out these incredibly complex interactions that are happening at the molecular level.
Are there reasons for concern about unintended consequences of this kind of research or these kind of efforts, side effects of trying to extend human life indefinitely?
Yeah, and that comes up all the time. I mean, one of the first things that people say to me whenever I talk to them about this is, well, oh my God, what are we gonna do with all these people? You know, it's a legitimate question. I don't know that there's a solution. I mean, any more than there was a solution whenever we started creating cars, you know, or cell phones. I mean, the truth is every technology is double-edged. They can be used for good or for ill. But if someone walked up to you and said, I could help you live pretty much as long as you want and you will be healthy, do you want to die instead? So what we really need to be thinking about as a society is, how are we going to handle this? Because I do believe it's going to happen, and I think it's going to begin to happen, you know, in the next 5 years.
There's also questions that people have raised about sort of the ethics of this. I mean, obviously, you talk about the vast amounts of money that are being poured into this in a world where there's a lot of other really pressing problems. Some would argue much bigger problems like global warming, like income inequality. Is there an argument for, you know, saying, hey, maybe this is not the best way to spend our resources at this very moment?
What happens is there's a need that's out there. You have a whole huge generation of baby boomers who are facing their mortality right now. So you have a lot of people out there that are in positions where they can begin to question those things. And they are questioning those things. And they have the resources. We can debate whether or not that's the best use of our resources, but the truth is the resources are being used and they're moving forward. And I think there's a huge need for it, so I think it's going to happen.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll talking with Chip Walter, author of Immortality, Inc. Walter speaks January 16th at Carnegie Library in Oakland. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. What are the hot neighborhoods in the city of Pittsburgh for residential, retail, and office? But do those new developments bring a price for current residents? Jones Lang LaSalle is taking a look at urban core neighborhoods, including Lawrenceville, the Strip District, and recently, the South Side. Joining us to take a look at the numbers are researchers with JLL, Toby Bilski, and Colin Potter. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you
for having us.
This latest report looked at a number of trends, but particularly population. You say there's about 11,600 people living in the South Side and a low vacancy rate of 3.5%. Are luxury apartment spaces like Glasshouse going to be enough to attract new tenants to the area?
Yeah, I think it will. There's a big urban migration right now of millennials coming into the downtown area. So this new inventory like the Glasshouse or different apartment complexes in the South Side in particular are going to attract those young professionals that live close to downtown.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have a lot of new developments going on all along East Carson. There's a lot of amenities both for younger professionals and also the older generations as well. You have everything from the High Line all the way up to the South Side Works. So it's kind of a lot to offer.
The report also looks at new commercial tenants, as we were alluding to, coming into the area. Southside will be home to a few newer businesses, including Sly Fox Brewery, Anytime Fitness, and the Vault Tap Room. What does the addition of new businesses mean for the future development in the Southside? Do businesses attract businesses, in other words?
Absolutely. I think businesses not only attract other businesses, but they attract for younger talents who kind of want to move to those areas. Mm-hmm. I think Southside has that going for them to where they have a lot of new tenants and a lot of new organizations are moving to the Southside. So it's all but good.
Mm-hmm. And all these developments, I mean, it's all related, right? So once you have an office development going in, the way to attract that young talent that Colin was referring to is that you're going to need those amenities and you're going to need places for these younger professionals to live. So the new development is great, and it's helping build the South Side to, you know, where it once was.
Speaking of where to live, new residential space cropping up on the South Side, in the South Side, I should say, but a lot of luxury apartment complexes. Does that draw any concern about increasing rent costs for current tenants and how this new luxury apartment might be very nice and it might be a demand for it? But what about the people currently living in that community?
Sure. If you're owning in that community, that is good news for you because that means your house value is going up. As for renters, it does make it a little bit trickier because, yes, your rent is going to increase because the overall market is increasing. But I think it's good to have that economic growth wherever you are because, as the old adage is, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. So we're all for the new development and the increase in the economic growth.
Mm-hmm. The residential component of the South Side, there is a fair contingent of college students. Mm-hmm. What might this do for them? So they might have nice amenities, but they might not be able to afford to live here in a place that they like.
I think that's one of the great things about Southside is that they offer both sides of the coin. So where they offer affordable houses for the college students, for Pitt, Duquesne, who live down there, who want to occupy their certain side. However, there's also space for young professionals to where if they want of something maybe a little bit nicer than what the college students may need,
right,
there's still those options, whether it's in Southside Works or the Glass House.
Have you seen in your study of the neighborhood, the Southside neighborhood, that newer residential developments have bumped up the prices for rent for the older, the more established, shall we say, housing complex, less fancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is an element of that for sure. It's not as pronounced as the new developments coming in. Those rents are much higher, but it does have an effect on the older inventory for sure.
Are the people to fill these Class A luxury apartments, who's the ideal candidate? Who are we talking about? Who wants these spaces?
Well, if you're looking, you're mentioning the residential part of it.
Right.
I believe it's whoever can afford it, right? Whoever is able to purchase these new the new condos, but then also who can pay for the rent in these areas. But really, the target audience for these types of developments will be the young professionals, the millennial generation, and the generation behind it, because that is who is living close to the downtown and working in the downtown area. So that's definitely the target audience here.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guests are researchers with JLL, Toby Bilski, and Colin Potter. The Highline development along the South Shore is expected to offer about 500,000 square feet of office and retail space by the time it's completed. Are there companies that want to move into those spaces?
There are. There was a healthcare technology company, Matrix, that did move there recently. And others like the beauty shop have come in and occupied space. I mean, the fringe is what we call it, the space that's directly around the downtown, the Golden Triangle, has seen a lot of activity for the past few years. A lot of it's coming from the technology companies and kind of the influx of those types of tenants.
Colin, this report is part of a larger effort by JLL to highlight growing areas in the region. How do you select which neighborhood to look at? How do you assess the potential of a community for additional growth?
Sure. Obviously, we like to examine the new developments and recent leasing activity within the neighborhoods. That's when we first kind of begin the process to look at which neighborhood maybe we should select next. We like to look at whether it's office, industrial, residential, take those all into account and kind of go from there. We look at new transactions. Maybe it's something that we really want to kind of get out there and make sure tenants are aware of and make sure that the general public can get as much information as possible.
Mm-hmm. How often do you do a neighborhood and have you decided on the next one?
Sure. So we do one every month. Oakland is next, along with East Liberty.
Are there any neighborhoods that are sort of under the radar that we might not, we hear about certain neighborhoods all the time, whether it's a South Side, a Strip District, maybe a Shady Side, that kind of thing. But are there neighborhoods that are sort of under the radar that you're keeping your eyes on?
Yes, there are. I think, you know, the neighborhoods that get a lot of the media attention, like East Liberty or Lawrenceville, they're kind of overshadowing the smaller neighborhoods like Bloomfield or Garfield. And I think Garfield is one to watch because it is in between the Lawrenceville and East Liberty neighborhoods. And there's a lot of activity there, a lot of new restaurants and new retail that's going in there that could really transform that area into the newer Lawrenceville.
So we've been talking about some neighborhoods, Southside being the most recent report, Oakland to be next, and others to come. What about beyond the city limits? Will you look at suburbs?
Sure. Obviously, there's still a lot of leasing activity and other development happening in the suburb areas. We're plans to do a year with the kind of urban core neighborhoods right, and kind of reevaluate after there.
Are we going to see in the suburbs more developments that are not spread out? You might call them, they're almost entire communities with residential and retail and even some entertainment complexes, maybe their movie houses.
Yeah.
Do you think we're going to see more of that in the suburbs?
I think as long as the current projects that are underway, as long as they're successful, I think we'll see that. Certainly projects like Newberry down in Bridgeville is a good example of that. I mean, it's still in the works, but there is an element of residential. There's medical there, and then there's going to be a lot more retail to follow up with the Topgolf and Carvana that's there now. So I think dependent on the success of that, and then you see different developments up in McCandless that are successful, like the block at Northway. I think those are good examples that will help investors make that decision to continue doing it here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, we see that McCandless Crossing is where we have a residential component, a lot of stores, a lot of restaurants.
And they're doing well.
Yeah,
they're doing well up there. The block at Northway is a good example of just a new development happening in the suburbs, and they're filling up quickly. And you know, it looks like, you know, every month or so there's a new tenant moving into the block at Northway. So I think those are good examples, good case studies for our city.
Mm-hmm. So is there a suburb that might be considered for early on if you do stretch out to the suburbs?
Yeah, I would suspect that. You know, up in McCandless, that would be a good candidate for that. Also, Bridgeville, South Fayette area. Those are good areas. You know, we have to chase where the new residential is popping up and where the good school districts are because retail will follow.
Toby Bilski and Colin Potter are researchers with JLL. Thanks to both of you for taking the time today.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, for the optimists, spring is not that far away. For the pessimists, that means orange barrels popping up all over. We'll talk with PennDOT District Executive Cheryl Moon Sirianni about major road projects and how that could impact you. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zenkovich, Caldwell Holden, and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Stay tuned to WESA this morning as NPR brings you live special coverage of an announcement from President Donald Trump. He's expected to address an ongoing Iranian missile attack against U.S. targets in Iraq. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.